today, finding a fourth straight line through a mini curved path.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
All right. Well, I'm actually really glad Daisy suggested that we talk with the vice presidents, because at Criswell College, where I serve, and I get to serve with them, because I really have been blessed, encouraged by each of them and each of their stories and the information they've shared and just the ideas they've given have been, I think, worth hearing. And I hope you feel exactly the same way. Today's I'm really excited about being able to share with you. And I don't get excited about very many things, so Daisy's actually a little dumbfounded that I used an emotional word talking through this. But I'm really pleased to introduce to you our Vice President for Student Affairs and Communications and our Dean of Students, Luis Juarez. So glad to have you in the studio today, Luis.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's really an honor, but also an exciting pleasure to be and just have a conversation with you, Dr. Creamer.
Cool. All right. So good. This is, I want people to hear your whole story. There are actually a lot of layers to this. And I'm saying this partially for the listener's sake, so they'll realize there's a really important part of your story that I kind of want to put off toward the end. And you know what I'm talking about. Yes. We'll get there eventually. But every other part of your story is also really fascinating, just because your background is different, richer in a lot of ways than a lot of the things I've experienced myself and others. So let me start with this, though. I always want to know when you became a follower of Christ. So your dad is a pastor, and you've been connected to and involved in ministry pretty much your entire life. But at some point, you yourself had to become a follower of Christ. So tell us about when that happened.
Absolutely. So Dad has been in ministry for almost 30 years, which meant that my sister and I grew up in a Christian home. We were exposed to Christianity and the church since I was 8 years old. And so, you know, going to church, my dad became or decided to follow the call to ministry just 1 year after he accepted the Lord. And so we've been very much involved, but it wasn't until I was 12 years old, after already singing at church, after already getting baptized at 9 years old. And you know, similar story to other PKs, you know, I felt like I needed to get baptized because everybody else was getting baptized. Mm-hmm. And because I was the son of the pastor, it made sense for me to get baptized. But it wasn't until I was 12 years old that I had a personal encounter with the Lord, specifically in Corpus Christi in 2001 at Congreso, which, if you know about Congreso, is the largest Hispanic gathering in North America of Hispanic students. And that was the first time that the gospel message really touched my heart, that made me realize that I was a sinner, that I needed to be forgiven of my sins, and that I needed to follow Jesus. And I also realized that it was because my parents made that decision that our lives were completely different.
The sort of the chain reaction of faith. They had faith, and that changed your trajectory also.
100%. Yeah. I was able to clearly identify that because we had peace, not money, but peace in our household, it was because of that peace that came from the forgiveness we found in Christ.
Yeah, and I'm curious about this Congreso, the meeting that happens. Is that Are 12-year-olds a part of that? Are 12-year-old students a part of that? Or were you a part of that because your dad was a part of it?
No. So 12 to 18 years
old. So you were going as a student.
I was going as a student.
Okay.
I was going to Corpus Christi 2001.
Yeah.
It was a transformative experience.
Yeah, obviously. And again, I love the testimony that it's the fact that you saw a difference in your parents' home, in your mom and dad's home. So fascinating.
Yes.
Okay, so let me ask you another question. You had that's a rebirth. You know, we talk about it all the time. This is the new birth. There's another kind of rebirth you had, we're not going to talk about all the details right now, but at least a part of it. It's not exactly the same thing. It's not like being born again, but it is a complete change to your life. You are originally from Nicaragua. That's where you were born and raised. And yet you became a U.S. citizen. So tell us about how long you've been a U.S. citizen. Let's talk about your citizenship.
Absolutely. 30 years. So I've been a U.S. citizen for 30 years now. And yes, I'm originally from Nicaragua. I am proud to be from Nicaragua. And I'm grateful that my parents always taught me to be proud of my nationality, but also grateful for the opportunity to be raised here in the United States after 7 years old and the opportunities, obviously, that came with that. But, every time I think of the country where I was born and I think about the food and I think about the culture, I'm just so grateful to my parents that they never allowed me to forget where I come from and the traditions and the culture that come with being from Nicaragua.
Yeah, and there's a thing. I want to ask you a follow-up question about this real quickly because a lot of people that I've talked to who have, I don't know if you have dual citizenship, by the way. Are you just a citizen of the U.S. or are you a citizen of both?
I'm a citizen of the U.S.
Okay. So single citizenship here.
Yes.
And yet, culturally, your background was in Nicaragua, and you, like you said, love the food. And just to be straightforward about it, I have gone out on the parking lot in the middle of the summer in Texas here and found Luis sitting in the middle of the parking lot absorbing the sun. Like, I just need to be outside of the air conditioning for a while, which is really interesting to me. You've brought Nicaragua with you. Some people have a sense that because, you would say, oh, I have two homes, Nicaragua and the U.S. Other people I've talked to, when they have sort of two backgrounds like that, will say, I kind of feel like a fish out of water in both places. So I'm curious which is true for you or if both are true. I don't know.
I think the latter would be true for me. However, ever since we arrived in the United States.
You were seven.
I was 7 years old.
United States.
I was 7 years old. Ever since we arrived in the United States, for one reason or another, we have always been on the go. We've always been going from state to state. Mm-hmm. Especially when my dad received the calling to ministry, it was church planting, and so he would plant a church in North Carolina, and then in different cities in North Carolina, and then in Texas, and then in Tennessee, and so
portability is sort of a normal thing for you.
It is
pick up and move.
It is. It really is.
Let's not do that anytime soon, Mr. Vice President.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Just as a side thought. Okay, all that said, let me go back and give a little more detail about the transition from Nicaragua to the U.S., and it starts with your dad. Is that do I remember correctly? I've heard your story before,
yes.
So I'm trying to ask the questions that fit it correctly. If I remember right, you said your dad came first. Can you talk about his move from Nicaragua to the United States?
Absolutely. So my dad was an atheist for a very long time. I always enjoy sharing this story because of the transformative, redemptive story in his life that really made an impact in my life. He grew up in one of the poorest corners in the country, in Nicaragua. At the age of 11 years old, he was part of the Sandinista Revolution War, right? He was a guerrillero.
Which people my age, we remember, you know, the names, the words. I remember hearing about all of this.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, and so at 11 years old, he was part of the war. And some people are asking, how is that even possible, an 11-year-old? Well,
you mean like with a gun?
With a bomb, right?
So, oh, my goodness.
So as an 11-year-old guerrillero, Maybe you don't have the skills of a soldier, but you are instructed to take a bomb and just go throw it at a particular place and just come back, right? And
the idea is guerrilla warfare.
And that is your participation. And so that's part of my dad's story. At the age of 15, he successfully fights the war, and the Sandinistas, you know, take over Nicaragua. And so at 15 years old, the person in command says, well, listen, you have gone through the program in the war successfully, but we can't put you in charge of a command or a large group of people because you're 15 years old. gave him the opportunity to go to college, go to university, and they said you can go to three places: Germany, Russia, or Cuba. And so because of the language, he chose Cuba. He goes to Cuba, and he is exposed, obviously, to communism. Matter of fact, on the first few weeks in Cuba, he was greeted by Fidel Castro. Everybody from Nicaragua, all the soldiers were greeted by Fidel, and so they felt important. They felt it was such a significant milestone in their lives. And so he begins his college career in industrial studies. More than education, though, however, he is radicalized, and he buys into this communist belief that there is no God.
Right.
And this is where the atheist in him is born, pretty much.
Right.
And so that story begins there. He finishes his studies in Cuba 3 years later, goes back to Nicaragua. And there he enters politics. He becomes this very successful politician and businessman and is really doing very well economically. He meets my mother, and, obviously, that's where
it
I come in.
It worked out.
It worked out. That's where I come into the picture. My sister as well, and he's having a good time. He's having a prosperous economic situation. It's not until, on one occasion, I am with him, and he's coming from the capital city of Managua to Nagarote, which is the city where we live, where we lived. But along the way, you know, he has a chauffeur. Along the way, some cars get in the way and some men get out.
Oh, man.
And threaten him and say, if you don't boycott this, then you and your son will be harmed, right? And so very hostile situation, very hostile life and environment. He gets home and he tells my mom, and my mom really makes it clear to him, I'm tired of this lifestyle. And it's either your family or this career, but I will not put in danger my son or our family. So you need to make a decision, your career or your family. And even though my dad has always been very ambitious and he loves his family, as an unbeliever, the values of family was very dear to him. He didn't have a dad. Mom was barely present, and so he wanted something different. Mm. And so he chose family.
Which meant he couldn't stay?
Which means that he had to turn away from his political career.
Right, okay.
And some career positions. Well, he did that, but that also brought enemies, right? And in the midst of that, a new government party took power in Nicaragua. And so that also meant that he would lose his influence. He would lose a lot of benefits. He tried to then get a visa to come to the United States. It was obviously denied.
And it was the government that he's getting the visa from.
Correct.
It's not friendly to him anymore.
Absolutely. So he's being denied visa to come to the United States. So he made a decision to do what millions of Hispanics in Central America and Latin America have done. He decided to take the journey to come to the United States illegally, right? Mm-hmm. And so he did that back, I believe, in 1991.
About 35 years ago or so.
Yes. And so he comes through that journey. You know, from Nicaragua, you got to go through Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Mexico, and then you're here. But he came through that journey, tough journey, one time. He made it to the United States, and he stayed in the United States for 1 year working.
What kind of work? Do you know?
Construction, okay, roofing.
Just whatever he could pick up.
Whatever he could pick up. It was almost a year. It was about the 11th month in the United States where he gets a call that grandma is dying or grandma is ill.
In Nicaragua?
In Nicaragua. Okay. And they really didn't share the full condition, the gravity of the condition of my grandmother, because they knew how hard it was for him to get there. And they were not sure if they wanted to influence him to come back. But he is aware that she is very ill. And he makes the decision to come back, and he doesn't tell anyone. Mm. He comes back to Nicaragua 3 days after she's been buried.
Ah.
And so he doesn't get the opportunity to say goodbye to his mom. Very tough. I do have vivid memories of the funeral and the last days with my grandmother.
You were really young then.
I was
really
young. I was five, maybe. And so he's back in Nicaragua, and he tells mom, okay, we need to go back to the United States. So now he goes back to the United States, this time with my mother. But he goes again illegally, right, to the United States.
And y'all are staying?
And my sister and I, we stay with my maternal grandmother.
Okay.
And so we stay back. So they go, and it was tough. It was tough. My mom tells the story of in Mexico, for example, they are being interviewed by police officers and maybe immigrant officers, and they bring my dad into a room. He comes back all bloody, right? Oh, wow. And so it was a tough journey for them. They get to Bronzeville, I believe, and they go, they try to cross the river. Along the way, immigrant officers catch them, and it's just very violent, right? They get my mom, and they hit my dad with my mom. Mm. They hit her face with his face, and the treatment is just very, very hard and very cruel. But anyways, they're caught by immigration, and they are put in a detention center in Brownsville. Mm-hmm. And they are there for about 4 months. They're there for about 4 months. They are released because a family member in the U.S. are able to claim them temporarily until they have a court date, etc. This is back in
the
1992. So I can't quite remember what the laws were back in the day and what was permitted, what was allowed to even temporarily. But that's the case. And so they are out of the detention center, and they're able to work and to do whatever they need to do. So they are there for a year. And then dad tells mom, there is no way we will be here for another month without our children. And so dad tells mom, you stay here. I'll go back to Nicaragua and bring them back.
Oh, do it all over again.
And so he begins that third journey. He goes back. And we start the journey from Nicaragua to the United States. We, my sister and I, and my dad, we start that journey. And it's not until we hit Guatemala that we are detained by immigration and sent back to Nicaragua.
Okay.
So the first try was unsuccessful. The second try, we do it all over again. And we finally reach Mexico, which if you... if you study the that journey, right, from
and let's just go on the assumption that no one has studied it. Tell us about it.
Whenever you look at that journey from Central America to the United States, when you reach Mexico, it's a milestone. From Guatemala to Mexico, that is one of the biggest tests in making sure you're going to get to the United States. We reach Mexico. And Mexico, you know, it's hard. It's hard to go through Mexico, especially because people can tell that you're not Mexican. Your accent, and you could just tell. And so going through Mexico is hard. At some point in Mexico, we reach Guadalajara, Mexico, and this atheist is having a conversation with God. This atheist, my dad, we reach a hotel in Mexico, and for the very first time, he feels defeated. He feels vulnerable. He has run out of money. And he has a conversation with God in a hotel in Guadalajara, Mexico.
And this is a successful politician, businessman, educated.
Very educated.
But he's kind of hitting the bottom right now.
He has hit rock bottom. But the arrogance in him even drives that conversation with God. He says, God, I don't need you, but my children need you. If you are real, allow them to see their mother once again. And so he's having this conversation. And from that point on, we take bus after bus. And immigrant officers go into the bus. They are checking for whoever is not a Mexican citizen, whoever is trying to go to the United States. And they look at us and they just look past us. That happened over and over again, in the bus, in the train. And we reached my mom's apartment in Geneva, Alabama, on December 25th, 1993.
Christmas Day.
Wow. Wasn't planned, obviously. It just landed on Christmas, knocking at her door.
Wasn't planned by you anyway.
It wasn't planned by me anyway. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I always tell people, out of all places, we landed in Geneva, Alabama, right? and if you know about Geneva, Alabama, it is at the border in Florida. And so at that time, you know, there was a lot of Hispanics working, picking up oranges, but also working in Georgia, in Florida, I'm sorry, in the, chicken factories.
Okay.
And that's where my mom and dad, you know, were working at the time.
Gotcha.
And so we reach Geneva, Alabama. Something I missed in that conversation with that atheist in God, my dad, he said, if you allow us to reach the United States, I promise you three things, right? He remember his Catholic background. He said, I promise you three things. If you grant me this this request, he said, number one, I'll stop drinking.
Okay.
I'll stop smoking and I will look for you. Huh. He said that, right? So when we reached Geneva, Alabama, he stopped smoking. He stopped drinking. But in 1993 in Geneva, Alabama, there were no Hispanic churches.
Wow.
And so he said, God, we are even. We are even, right?
Because there's no Hispanic church to go look for.
I can't look
God.
For you. I'm not going to go into an English-speaking church. I don't understand anything. But God has a sense of humor, of course. A week later, Mom lost her job. 2 weeks later, Dad loses his job. And the contractor that hired him said, I have a job for you, but it's in North Carolina.
Wow.
And my dad says, I don't know where North Carolina is at. And so he says, go to Walmart, buy a map, circle Geneva, Alabama, and then circle Siler City, North Carolina. Get there in a week if you want a job.
Wow.
So we sell everything from our in our apartment, all the furniture, and we land in Siler City, North Carolina, a week later. The next afternoon, we got a knock on the door. We are from Iglesia Bautista Roca Fuerte, and we're here to visit with you. The Lord looking for that atheist who had one more promise.
Yeah, that's right.
That he needed to fulfill.
That's pretty great.
We attended that church one Sunday, a second Sunday, the third Sunday, my dad gave his life to Christ.
Wow. And you said it wasn't long at all until he himself committed to the ministry too. Is that right?
That is right. A year later, he committed to ministry and he went to plant a church. Now, I'm not here to recommend that a year after you have an encounter with Christ, you go plant a church or pastor a church.
But you weren't recommending for immigrants to arrive on Christmas Day.
That's right.
God still does that too.
That's so. Right. That's
yeah,
right.
It's really funny. So he gets involved in ministry. I'm assuming you go with him wherever he's planting a church.
Yes.
That's where your family goes.
That's right.
So how does that, where does that leave you, you know, when you're still a young man, right?
So whenever he decided to be a church planter, I was 9, 10 years old.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so he plants his first church in Apex, North Carolina. And probably 7 months into it, he figures out he needs some training. He needs some theological training. And that's when he decides to go to San Antonio to study at the Hispanic Theological School, which is now known as Baptist University of the Americas.
Right.
And obviously the whole family goes with him. I'm 10 years old. I'm 11 years old. And then in that trajectory, that's where, you know, I'm starting to realize what Christianity is really about.
Right.
And even though in seminary, right, we have no money, we still find a way to be at peace and we still find a way to find joy in everything that we do and everything that's taking place until I realize what is the source of that joy? What is the source of that peace? Jesus Christ and the new life that we find in him. And that's where I have that encounter with Christ at 12 years old in Corpus Christi at an event, but then obviously more than just a one-time event, an ongoing understanding of Christ, what Christ did for me, right?
Yeah.
And the hope that I find in him.
So this is 12 years old that you're converted.
Yes.
You become a follower of Christ. And your dad is finishing seminary at some point in there, or the work that he was doing down at Baptist University of the Americas.
That's
right.
San
Antonio. Did y'all stay in San Antonio long, or did he go back to North Carolina, or where'd y'all go from there?
So he graduates late 2001, and we go back to actually Tennessee. We go to Tennessee to plant a church. So we plant a church, two churches in Tennessee for about 6 months until a pastor comes and takes over.
Okay.
And then we go to North Carolina, 2002, to plant another church. And that would be a church that we plant and stay there for the next 10 years.
Okay. Now I'm going to interrupt your story for a minute because I want to introduce another question. I wanted people who are listening and haven't met you, don't know you, to get to know you first and then to hear this part of the story. So here's what I want to ask you. And it's based on the fact that you're one of the most capable people I know. I have met very few people as ambitious and motivated. And I mean ambitious in a good way, like you're going to do stuff and you want to accomplish things and you work hard at it and you're going to make it happen. And once you're in a room with somebody, you know, it's obvious you have an intentionality about your life that's not going to change. So I love all of that about you. I'm saying all of that because what I'm about to say may sound offensive to somebody. So here's the thing. You're one of the most capable people I know. And yet you are not just a minority because you're from Nicaragua and you have a Hispanic heritage. And so here you are in the United States as a minority. You're a double minority for some reason. So would you share with us how you became a double minority?
So. Yes, of course. Of course. It's obviously part of my story and something that has impacted, changed not only my life, but my family's life and those around me. So we're in North Carolina and grateful for the opportunity to be part of my dad's ministry, my ministry. You know, everything in life was just perfect. Everything was great. I was very involved in church, always looking to use my abilities and talents to serve God to the best of my ability. Mm-hmm. I always tell the story, I was 17 years old. I was a junior in high school, overflowing with dreams. I had many dreams in my life. And like any teenager, every week it was something different. I wanted to be an actor because I wanted to be surrounded by beautiful, gorgeous women. and my dad would often says, well, that's going to be an issue when you get married, if you become an actor, because you'll probably have to, kiss other women. and I said,
glad he's thinking long term.
I said, Dad, I have to provide for my family. And so, and so I have to do what I have to do. Right. Another week, I want to be something else. And I wanted to become the starting point guard of the best basketball team in the world.
So the Mavericks, the Dallas Mavericks.
No. The Los Angeles Lakers, right?
Well, I tried.
The Los Angeles Lakers. And we're probably hearing a lot of boos, especially here in the DFW. But that was a dream of mine. Love basketball. I grew up, when my dad was in seminary, we used to play. He was Shaq and I was Kobe, right? And so we grew up admiring.
Weren't rooting for the Spurs in San Antonio. You were rooting for the Lakers.
Well, it was interesting because the Spurs went back and forth with the Lakers, and the Lakers would beat them every time, at least in the early 2000s. And so we became just fans of the Lakers, especially that dynamic duo of Shaq and Kobe. And so I wanted to become the starting point guard for a basketball team for the Lakers. I saw myself there. And at the age of 17, I suffered an automobile accident that threatened the dreams that I had and that potentially God had placed in my heart.
Can you talk about the accident? Were you driving? What was going on?
Absolutely. So we were coming out of a groundbreaking service. I was the worship leader at my church, and we had led worship, and we asked the Lord to bless the land in which the church was going to build. And so afterwards, I got in the back of the car, and with the worship team, it was four of us, and we were going to one of my friend's house, and the driver, took off, and he was going a little fast, and some deer got in the way. And so he made the mistake to try to avoid the deer. And so in that, we flipped numerous times. I was ejected from the back window of the car. And when we landed, I landed just to the side of the car. And so I could have been crushed. But nonetheless, I did injure my spinal cord. It was a very tragic accident. I was the only one severely hurt. The other three, had scratches, but nothing severe like me. It was February 13, 2005, around 8 p.m. And my parents are receiving calls. Back in 2005, we're not so attached to our telephone. To our cell phone.
Right.
And so they had left their cell phone at home and, gone somewhere else. They get home and they have about 20 missed calls. And the voicemail reads to my dad, there has been an accident and some of your members, some of your young church members have been involved. So my dad goes to the scene. And that he understands that I'm obviously one of those individuals. When they get to the scene, my mom always tells the story that they were about three fire trucks, two ambulances, so many police cars. And so they are not able to park close to even see where I'm at. So they get out of the car and they start rushing to the scene.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And she tells the story that is the furthest she has ever ran. And when they get close, they are lifting me up into the ambulance, and I am just, foam is coming out of my mouth.
Oh.
And you could tell that it is really severe. So they take me to the local hospital, and my dad gets there, my mom gets there, everybody in the local hospital knows my dad because he's the local pastor.
He's been there to
visit. Been there when people give birth and where people are sick, he goes there to visit. And so the nurse immediately recognizes Pastor Pablo. He says, "Pastor, I'm so glad that you're here. We need your help. There are four young men that just had a car accident, and three of them are okay, but one of them, he's dying. And we need your help to try to identify the parents." So they take him to the room where the three young men who are okay, where they are. And he immediately knows that I'm not there. And so they take him to where I'm at. And the nurse says, "Pastor, we need to call his parents. We don't know if he's going to make it through the night. We need your help, Pastor." And my dad said, "He's my son." And so they start weeping. And the next 24 hours were critical, or are critical. They fly me out to a bigger hospital in Greenville, North Carolina, where they would perform surgery the minute that I got there, or immediately. And that is the hospital where I would be for the next 5 months in physical therapy. That's the place where I learned that my diagnosis, that I would not be able to walk again. I don't remember when the doctors actually said that to me, because, you know, I was still probably drugged up and
can't even imagine.
I don't remember. God protected me also from the trauma of remembering the accident. I am able to remember maybe 2 hours before the accident, and then days after the surgery. It was tough. It was tough for me. It was definitely tough for my family. My dad was a rookie pastor still, and he couldn't understand how such tragedy could happen to a ministerial family, who, even though they weren't perfect, to a young kid who was not perfect, but who was serving God, right? He wasn't getting drugged up or getting drunk every weekend. He was at church every weekend.
That day. Leading worship.
That day. And he couldn't understand why that could happen to him. I was also very angry, very confused. But even in his anger, in his frustration, the Lord used my dad to speak into my life. And I'll never forget the scripture he shared with me, John 16:33, where he says that, where Jesus says, "In this world you will face difficulties." And then he says, but take heart, because I have overcome the world. And my dad elaborated and said, "Son, in this world, you already know we've faced a lot of challenges. And right now we are facing a disability that is completely out of our control. But we can hold to God's promise that not only is he with us, but he has been victorious. And because he's been victorious, we can count on being victorious as well."
I can't even imagine the process you had to go through personally of resolving where your life, you know, would go from there. But if I fast forward to the part where I finally meet you, you know, and am introduced to you, I will say, I mean, you are in a chair, and so your transportation is with you all the time in some ways. And it's funny because I don't know if people say this to you, Luis, but, you know, when I was being told, "Hey, you're going to meet this guy. I think he's the next director of admissions for us. You know, he's a really good guy." They also described your disabilities and then said, but I really think it's, you know, it's like a contrast. But the truth is, I met you and there's that one moment where it's like, oh, he's in a chair. And then right after that, you just forget. You just completely forget. It's gone. I don't know if it's your personality or what it is, or just the conversation or what it is that does it. But I don't know if people say that to you often, but it is true. It's like, it's just not there. It's not a thing. I don't know how you manage that, but and I don't know how you manage. So I would just love to hear, what's the step for you? What's the process for you where you go, yeah, we're just going to go forward? Is it what you were just describing with your dad?
So there was a lot of fear at that time.
I can imagine.
There was a lot of fear. And, you know, I think I've shared this maybe once or twice only. But as a young man, as a 17-year-old man, the first thought that came to my mind after the accident was, is anybody wanna marry me?
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't really concerned about future dreams, plans, but as a 17-year-old man,
sure,
young man, is anybody going to find me attractive or have any interest in spending the rest of their lives with me? And so I said that to my dad. And then my dad said, I have a visitor coming tomorrow. I want you to ask him that question. You see, something that I didn't share was that the pastor that led us to Christ when we came to North Carolina was a quadriplegic.
Is that right?
In a wheelchair.
I don't think you ever told me that.
I don't think so either.
Wow.
And my dad was his right hand. Huh. Everywhere the pastor went, my dad went. We didn't have, or he didn't have a handicap accessible van like I do. So my dad had to carry him.
Wow.
Right? My dad cared for him for a long time. And I saw everything my dad did, you know, to help him. I saw how the Lord used him.
Wow.
I also saw when the Lord brought a beautiful wife to his life. And so they indeed came the next day, and he came to my hospital room with his wife. Hmm. My dad said, ask him. Ask him. And so that was a reminder. It didn't take away my fears.
Right.
It did not take away my fears and my doubts, but it did give me hope.
Can we fast forward to where that hope was fulfilled? Because one of my favorite stories you've told in the past is about meeting your wife. You want to tell
yes.
about that real quick?
Yes, of course. I am giving a conference in Nashville, Tennessee in 2013. And I'm also a recruiter for the institution I used to work for. And I'm sharing my story and you know, my testimony, but also—
It's like a chapel service type
thing. It's just like, it's like youth rally, right?
Okay.
It is a youth rally. So after I share my story, I go back to where the crowd, the youth are, you know, in the middle. And everybody's jumping, we're worshiping, and everybody's just having a good time. And so am I. I never shy away from a good time. And, you know, we're just worshiping God, and everybody around me is jumping. And so I feel the presence of somebody coming behind me, and is this beautiful Mexican girl. And she whispers in my ear and says, "Don't worry, brother, I will jump for you." And I always tell the story. She's been jumping for me ever since. We, you know, we had a conversation afterwards, and she had just graduated high school, looking where to go to college. And I said, "Well, you know, there is a college in San Antonio if you're interested. You're looking to do business, and they offer business. Here's an application." And so she immediately filled out the application as a responsible and good recruiter. I kept in touch, sure. Right? I kept in touch. And she would come to be a student the next semester. We became friends, eventually started dating, got engaged, and married in July 3rd, 2016.
Yeah, very exciting. And you know, I know her now, and, you know, she has worked for us for a while as well. And also works for Convencion.
Yes.
And Cecia, you know, yes. is your wife. So Yeah. How long have y'all been married now?
So this July it'll be 9 years.
9 years. Okay. This July it'll be. Did you think through that ahead of time, or do you remember accurately?
I remember. Matter of fact, if you ask us both, she'll pause and she'll let me answer. And then, you know, so that she doesn't get embarrassed, I go ahead and say the date. And
you get it right.
I get it right.
Yeah,
that's
good
right.
Good for you. So listen, I mean, that's the part of the story I wanted everybody to hear. And the funny thing is, I have no idea how much more story there is for you, but it seems like a lot. You, again, became our vice president for student affairs, as well as communications, and our dean of students. And you're in a program that we're supportive of that is designed to help you be equipped to become, you know, on a trajectory to become a college president at some point. I think all of that seems kind of automatic as I look at you and where you are right now. And you're finishing a doctoral program at Mary Hardin Baylor.
That's right.
Right? Mary Hardin Baylor.
Yes.
So I want to make sure I got the school right.
Yes.
But, you know, hopefully anticipating probably December or something like that, that you would be able to walk. So
yes.
what an exciting trajectory so far. But for us, you know, it's a fascinating story to hear. And for you, it's like I said, it's a mini curved path. I don't know how to ask this question, Luis, so I'm just going to make the point and then just let you say whatever you want to say about it. But if you had said, hey, this is the path I'm going to take from Nicaragua to the United States, to a car accident, to the ministry instead of something else that I was going to do, you just, no way on earth. At 7 years old, especially, you know, living in Nicaragua, no way on God's green earth would you have even thought that. And yet looking back on it, and especially now, you've included some of the details of the story, you know, your dad's pastor being a quadriplegic himself, so on.
Yes.
It just seems hard to miss that God had a very direct path for you and that you're right on it. That's how it feels to me. Any comments on that before we're done?
100%. No one, you know, I always tell the story, you have so many plans in life, so many dreams. Being in a wheelchair was not one of my plans. It wasn't one of my dreams. It's something that happened, but I am so grateful that the Lord's hand has been in my life from the very beginning. And it was an automobile accident. It wasn't a life accident. He knew exactly what he was doing. I always go back to the four people who were in that car. Three of them did not have the supportive dad that I did.
Wow.
Those three guys in the car did not have the supportive family that I did. And I'm so grateful to the Lord, because even in the midst of something so tragic, so sad, so tough and hard, my dad has been a gift. My mom has been a gift. My sister has been a gift. And the local church where the Lord brought us to in North Carolina was so impactful in my life. I always tell people the local church is so special, and it made a difference in my life, the local church. I'm so grateful for God, for his blessings, his provision through all that.
Amen. That's the whole picture. Luis Juarez, thanks so much for being on
Thank
this
you.
Episode.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.